The morning I nearly ruined everything began the same way every morning did, with cold water, cracked knuckles, and the sound of the castle waking up around me like a giant exhaling its first breath. I heard the bells before I even opened my eyes. 5 strikes. My signal. I was already dressed before the 6th. That was the rhythm of my life inside Castle Dravenmoor. Not music, not laughter, not the kind of slow, golden mornings I sometimes saw through the upper windows when the noble ladies stretched lazily across their balconies. My mornings were linen and lye soap, ash buckets, and heavy silence. I was Rose, the head maid of the East Wing, and I had learned very early that being invisible was not a flaw in this place. It was a survival skill. The East Wing of Dravenmoor was assigned to the Alpha King's private library, his war room, and the long corridor that connected both to his personal chambers. My job was to keep all 3 spotless, stocked, and silent. I was not supposed to be seen. I was not supposed to be heard. And under absolutely no circumstances was I supposed to be present when the king himself walked those halls. I had managed that for nearly 2 years. Until today. The library smelled of old parchment and pine resin. A smell I had come to love quietly, the way you love things that were never meant for you. Hundreds of maps hung along the east wall, curled at the edges, marked with red ink that traced borders and battle lines across territories I would never visit. The shelves reached the ceiling, and there was a rolling ladder on iron rails that I used every 3rd morning to dust the highest volumes. That ladder was my favorite part of the job. Up there, above the world, with the pale winter light cutting through the leaded windows, I could almost forget what I was. Almost. I was halfway up the ladder when I heard the door. Not the servant's side entrance, the main door. The heavy oak one with the iron wolf's head knocker that was only used by people who didn't need to knock anywhere else. It swung open without warning, without sound, with the kind of ease that belonged only to someone who owned every room he entered. I froze. My dustcloth was in my hand. My blonde braid was escaping its pins. And King Xander of Dravenmoor was standing in the doorway of his own library, staring up at me with those pale blue eyes that always looked like they were calculating something the rest of the world hadn't figured out yet. He was not supposed to be here. He was never in the East Wing before noon. Everyone knew that. The senior staff had built the entire morning schedule around that fact. The maids cleaned first, the guards rotated second, and only then did the king's morning begin. Far away, in the South Tower, where his council met at 7:30. But there he was. No council. No guards flanking him. No formal announcement. Just Xander. Dark braids pulled back from his face. A deep scar tracing the line of his jaw. Dressed in his black leather and iron buckles like he'd come straight from somewhere that required armor. His blue eyes moved from my face to the ladder, to the cloth in my hand. And for one terrible moment, neither of us said anything. I started to climb down. Don't. His voice was not loud. It never was. That was the thing about Xander that the servants whispered about in the kitchens. He never raised his voice, and somehow that made everything worse. When a man who could silence a war council with a single word told you not to move, your body simply obeyed before your mind had a chance to argue. I stopped climbing. 1 foot still on the rung. 1 hand still on the rail. "What are you doing up there?" he asked. "Dusting, Your Majesty." My voice came out steadier than I felt. That surprised me. He walked into the room. Not quickly. Xander never moved quickly unless he had a reason to. But with that measured, heavy stride that made the floorboards announce him 2 steps before he arrived. He stopped at the base of the ladder and looked up at me with an expression I couldn't name. Not anger. Not indifference. Something more careful than both. "Dusting," he repeated. "The upper shelves collect condensation from the windows in winter. If left untreated, the leather bindings..." I stopped myself. I was explaining my work to the Alpha King. That was not something maids did. "Forgive me. I'll finish another time." "You'll fall if you climb down in a hurry." That was not what I expected him to say. I didn't answer. I began descending slowly, deliberately, my heart making considerably more noise than my feet on the iron rungs. When I reached the floor and turned, he was closer than I'd anticipated. Not uncomfortably close, but close enough that I could see the map ink stain on his right wrist and the deep lines of exhaustion carved beneath his eyes. He looked, for the first time in the 2 years I had observed him from careful distances, like a man who had not slept.
"Your name," he said.
"Rose, Your Majesty, East Wing Senior Maid." Something flickered across his face. Not recognition, exactly. More like the sensation of placing a sound you've heard before but couldn't locate. "You've been in this wing for how long?"
22 months, sire."
He was quiet. Then he moved past me toward the central desk, the massive oak one buried under maps and sealed correspondence, and sat down heavily in the leather chair. Not like a king settling into his throne. Like a man who had run out of places to stand. I should have left. Protocol was clear. When the king entered a room you were cleaning, you gathered your things, and slipped out through the servants' passage without drawing attention. I had practiced that exit 100 times in my head, but I noticed something then that made me hesitate. On the desk, partially buried under a stack of border maps, was a letter. I recognized the red wax seal. The Cressmore crest, the family of Lady Seraphine, the woman who was to become Queen of Dravenmore in 11 days. I had pressed and arranged the guest linens for her arrival myself. I knew that seal the way I knew the smell of trouble, instinctively, in my chest, before my mind named it. The letter was open, and the expression on the king's face as he stared at it was not the expression of a man reading a letter from someone he was at peace with. I told myself it was none of my concern. I began gathering my supplies quietly. The cloth, the small bottle of leather conditioning oil, the soft brush. "Does it bother you?" he said suddenly. I paused. "Your Majesty?" "Working in a room full of things you'll never use." He gestured at the shelves, the maps, the stacked volumes of law and history. "Reading any of it?" The question was strange enough that I answered honestly before I thought better of it. "I've read most of the lower shelves, the ones I can reach without the ladder." The silence that followed was different from the ones before it. Heavier, but not unkind. Xander looked at me then. Really looked. The way people rarely looked at the staff. And I felt the full weight of those pale blue eyes like a cold hand pressed flat against my sternum. "Come back tomorrow morning," he said. "Same time." I didn't understand. "Sire? There are documents in the upper archive I need cross-referenced with the Halvern territory maps. My steward doesn't know this library the way someone who has spent 22 months in it would." He looked back at the desk. "Come back tomorrow. Early." I stood there for a moment with my cleaning supplies in my hands and the winter light pressing cold against the windows, trying to understand what had just happened. "Yes, Your Majesty," I said finally. And I left through the main door, not the servant's passage, because he had not told me which one to use. And somehow that small detail felt like the first crack in a wall I hadn't known I was standing against. Outside in the corridor, I pressed my back against the cold stone and let myself breathe. 11 days until the royal wedding. And the king had just looked at me like I was someone worth remembering. I did not sleep well that night. The servants' quarters were located in the lower east wing, a long row of narrow rooms carved into the stone like afterthoughts. Functional, drafty, and perpetually smelling of candle wax and the lavender bundles we hung above the doors, to keep the dampness from settling into everything. My room was the last one on the left, which meant I had a half window that looked out at the base of the outer wall rather than the courtyard, and I had always considered that a small mercy. I did not need to watch the world from that window. I needed to sleep. But sleep would not come. I lay on my back in the dark and stared at the ceiling and thought about the way Xander had said come back tomorrow. Not as an order delivered to a servant, the way he might tell a footman to polish the silver or instruct a kitchen boy to restock the woodpile. There had been something considered about it. Deliberate. Like a man who had weighed the words before releasing them. I was overthinking it. That was what I told myself around the second hour of staring at the ceiling. He needed documents cross-referenced. I knew the library. It was a practical decision, nothing more. I repeated that 12 times and still did not believe it entirely. By the time the 5 bell rang, I had already braided my pale hair back, pressed my uniform smooth with my palms, and was standing outside the library's main door with a lantern in one hand and a nervousness in my stomach that I had no appropriate name for. He was already inside. That surprised me again. The fire had been lit. Not by a servant, I realized, because no servant had been scheduled for that room before me this morning. He had lit it himself. He was standing at the central desk with his back to the door, one hand braced on the oak surface, bent over a spread of maps that covered every inch of the table. "Close the door," he said, without turning. I did. The library felt different with him in it. Smaller somehow, despite being one of the largest rooms in the East Wing. Or perhaps it was simply that Xander occupied space differently than most people. Not aggressively. Not with the performative dominance I had seen from some of the visiting lords who swept through Dravenmoor and needed every room to know it. It was quieter than that. More like gravity. A pull that reorganized everything around it without announcing itself. "The Halvern maps," he said, gesturing to the left wall. "Upper third shelf, second section. There should be 5 rolls. Bring them here." I set down my lantern and moved to the ladder. This time, I did not hesitate at the height. I found the rolls quickly. They were labeled in faded brown ink, each one dated, each one sealed with a small strip of ribbon that had long since lost its color. I brought them down one by one and laid them on the only clear corner of the desk. He unrolled the first one without ceremony and smoothed it flat with both hands. I stepped back, thinking that was the end of my usefulness for the moment. But he said, "Stay. I need you to read the reference notations while I compare the boundary lines." And so began the strangest morning of my life at Dravenmoor. For 2 hours, we worked side by side at that desk, he tracing lines on the maps with a carved bone stylus, I reading aloud from the archive logs that recorded every territorial agreement between Dravenmoor and the Halvern region over the past 40 years. It was painstaking work. Dry work. The kind that required focus and patience, and the ability to read footnotes written in 3 different hands across crumbling parchment. I had always been good at that kind of work. It was the thing I had never been able to explain to the other maids, who preferred the rhythm of physical tasks. The scrubbing, the folding, the efficient management of linens. Those things were fine. But this, finding the thread between an old notation and a current map, tracing where agreements had been honored or quietly abandoned, this was the kind of thinking I had done alone, in secret, every time I read a volume from the lower shelves on my lunch breaks. At some point, I stopped reading from the log and started summarizing, pulling out only the relevant lines, and placing them in sequence without being asked to. I realized what I'd done when Xander went still beside me. "You're not reading anymore," he said. "No, sire." I braced for correction. "I can go back to the exact text if... you've organized it." He looked at the notes I had made on the margin sheet without asking permission to use it. Brief, precise, arranged chronologically. "In 20 minutes. I apologize. I should have asked before writing on the... Rose." He said my name like a period at the end of a sentence. Not sharp. Just final. "Stop apologizing for being useful." I closed my mouth. He looked at the margin notes for a long moment, then back at the maps. Something shifted in his expression. Not warmth. Not yet. But the careful neutrality he wore like armor developed a small hairline fracture. Where did you learn to read like this? He asked. My father was a record keeper, I said, for a minor territory lord in the north. Before he passed, he taught me his system. And you became a maid. It wasn't accusatory. It was simply an observation, delivered with the same flat precision he seemed to apply to everything. But it landed in me like a stone dropped into still water, spreading rings I couldn't stop. Opportunities are rarely distributed evenly, Your Majesty, I said quietly. He said nothing for a moment. Then, no, they are not. We returned to the work. But something had shifted in the room. Not dramatically, not in a way I could have pointed to and named. It was more like the temperature of a space adjusts when a window is cracked open, barely perceptible. But real. Around mid-morning, a knock came at the main door. It was Corwin, the king's personal steward, a stiff, formal man in his 50s with silver hair and the permanent expression of someone who had been managing disasters quietly for decades. He opened the door, registered my presence at the desk beside the king, and did an extraordinary job of not reacting visibly. Your Majesty, Corwin said. Lady Seraphine's delegation has arrived at the south gate, 2 days ahead of schedule. The temperature in the room dropped. Xander did not move immediately. He looked down at the maps for exactly 3 seconds, I counted, and then straightened and set down the stylus. Prepare the Amber reception hall. I'll receive her in an hour. Of course. Corwin's eyes moved briefly to me, then away. Should I send someone to relieve? Leave the East Wing schedule as it is, Xander said. Rose will continue the archive work. Corwin nodded and withdrew, closing the door with the particular precision of a man who knew better than to let a door make noise around the king. Xander rolled the nearest map carefully and secured it with the ribbon. He did not look at me. The third archive log, he said. The one from the border reassignment of 41 years ago. Find the original agreement and mark any clauses that were amended in the subsequent decade. Yes, Your Majesty. He picked up his leather riding gloves from the corner of the desk. I hadn't noticed them there before, and moved toward the door. He stopped with his hand on the frame, his back still to me. Lady Seraphine's arrival does not change the work, he said. Be here tomorrow. And then he was gone. I stood alone in the library with the fire crackling and the maps spread across the desk and the third archive log open in my hands, and I thought about the letter with the Crestmore seal I had seen the day before, and the shadows under his eyes, and the way he had said the work as though it were something separate from everything else in his life. Something protected. Outside, I could already hear the distant sound of horses and formal announcement. The Lady Seraphine arriving at Dravenmoor, 2 days early, for a wedding that was now 10 days away. I opened the archive log and began to read. Because that was what I did. I made myself useful in the margins of other people's lives, in the quiet spaces no one else thought to look. What I did not know then was that someone had begun to look. Lady Seraphine was everything I was not. I understood that within the first hour of her arrival, not because anyone told me, no one told the maids anything directly, but because I could read a room the way my father had taught me to read a document. Look at what's emphasized. Look at what's missing. Look at where the weight falls. The weight of Dravenmoor fell entirely toward her the moment she stepped through the south gate. I watched from the upper corridor window, the narrow one near the linen storage that overlooked the reception courtyard. Lady Seraphine descended from her carriage in deep, burgundy wool, her dark hair arranged in an elaborate structure of braids and pins that probably required 2 attendants and an hour of preparation. She was tall, composed, and carried herself with the particular kind of confidence that comes not from courage, but from never having been made to feel small. Behind her came 6 ladies-in-waiting, 2 advisors in Crestmore colors, and 4 guards who looked like they had been selected for the intimidating quality of their jawlines. Xander met her in the courtyard, I watched him stand at the base of the stone steps in his formal black. No riding leather today, no iron buckles, the full weight of his rank expressed in the quiet severity of his posture. He was courteous. He extended his hand. He said something I could not hear from the window, and Seraphine smiled the smile of a woman who had been rehearsing this arrival for a long time. I turned away from the window before I could watch more. The following 3 days settled into a pattern I did not anticipate. Every morning before the castle's formal schedule began, I was in the library. Every morning, Xander was already there. We worked. Truly worked. In the way I had only ever worked alone. Moving through the Halvern archive systematically, building a picture of 40 years of territorial agreements that had eroded quietly while no one was paying close enough attention. I learned, through the documents and through the occasional direct question he directed at me, that the Halvern situation was not simple. A contested border region had been shifting incrementally for years. Small adjustments that individually meant nothing but collectively had redistributed significant land and resource access in ways that now required Dravenmoor's formal response. The upcoming wedding, the alliance with the Crestmore family, was partly political, I gathered. Lady Seraphine's family held influence over 2 of the 3 Halvern-adjacent territories. I did not say that I understood the political architecture. I simply organized the evidence in the way that made it most visible. On the 4th morning, Xander looked at the summary I had prepared, 3 pages, cross-referenced, with the disputed clauses flagged in the margin, and was quiet for a long time. "My council has been working on this for 4 months," he said finally. "I have the advantage of knowing where everything is stored," I said carefully. "That's not what I meant." I looked at him.
He was looking at the document. "They see what they expect to see," he said. "You see what's actually there." I didn't know how to respond to that, so I said nothing. But something in my chest did something inconvenient, and I focused very deliberately on the next page of archive text until it passed. What I had not anticipated was Seraphine. Not her presence. I had anticipated that, planned around it, adjusted my routes through the castle to avoid the south and central wings where her delegation had settled like a weather system. What I had not anticipated was that she would come to the east wing. She arrived on the 5th day after her early appearance at Dravenmoor, in the mid-morning, while I was alone in the library reorganizing the rolled maps into their correct archive casings. Her ladies-in-waiting waited in the corridor. She came in alone, which told me something about her. She was the kind of woman who did reconnaissance herself. She was even more striking up close. Sharp green eyes that moved across a room the way a hawk's eyes move across a field. Not looking for beauty, looking for information. Those eyes found me quickly. "You're the maid," she said. Not unkindly. Simply as a category. "Yes, my lady. Rose. East Wing senior maid." She looked around the library slowly. At the desk, at the maps, at the margin notes that I had not yet put away, because I had not expected anyone to enter this morning. Her gaze stopped on the notes. "Whose work is that?" she asked. "Mine, my lady. I've been assisting with archive organization." Seraphine walked to the desk and looked at the notes without touching them. Her expression did not change, but something behind it shifted. A small, precise recalibration. Xander doesn't typically involve staff in document work. "I believe it was a practical decision, my lady. I know the location of the archive materials." She looked at me then with those hawk eyes, and I held very still. The way you hold still when something much larger than you is deciding what category you belong in. "How long have you been in the East Wing?" she asked. "Nearly 2 years, my lady." "And in that time, has the king ever spoken to you directly before this week?" The question was precise. It deserved a precise answer. "No, my lady." Seraphine was quiet for a moment. Then she smiled. A real smile, which was somehow more unsettling than a cold one. "I see," she said softly. She left without touching anything, her footsteps unhurried and deliberate down the corridor. I stood in the library afterward and felt the particular discomfort of having been understood by someone who had not been meant to understand anything. That evening, in the servants' hall, I sat with the only two people at Dravenmoor I trusted with the weight of my actual thoughts. Petra was the castle's head laundress, a broad, warm woman in her 40s, with ink-dark hair and a laugh that could fill a room without effort. She had been at Dravenmoor for 15 years and knew every current of power that moved through the place before the people generating those currents were aware of them. Beside her was Finn, a young man of 23, who worked as a junior record keeper in the administrative offices and had a talent for listening that made people say things to him they hadn't intended to say. I told them about Seraphine's visit to the library. Petra's expression went careful in the way it did when she was thinking seriously. She came to the East Wing herself? Not through her steward? Herself, alone. Finn turned his cup slowly in his hands. That's deliberate. She's mapping the territory. She's going to be queen in 6 days, I said. It's reasonable that she'd want to understand the castle. She doesn't want to understand the castle, Petra said quietly. She wants to understand what changed. Something has changed, and she felt it within 5 days of arriving. She looked at me steadily. Rose, be careful. I'm not doing anything. I know you're not, Petra said. That's not what I mean. She paused. There are people in this castle who have been hoping the Crestmoor Alliance would fall through, and there are people who have been hoping it would hold. Both groups notice things. Both groups will use things. Be careful about what you allow yourself to become in someone else's story. I thought about that for a long time after dinner, walking the cold corridor back to my room. Be careful about what you allow yourself to become in someone else's story. But the thing Petra didn't know, the thing I hadn't told her, because I was not certain I had the right words for it yet, was that for the first time in 2 years of careful invisibility, I was no longer entirely sure I was a background detail. And I didn't know yet if that was something to protect or something to fear. The answer came faster than I expected. The next morning, I arrived at the library at 5 bells to find the door already open, the fire already lit, and a note on the desk in Xander's handwriting, brief, unadorned, the way all his communications seemed to be. The council has requested a formal review of the Halvern documents. The session is tomorrow. I need your summary prepared for 12 council members who will look for every reason to dismiss what they see. Write it so they cannot. I read it twice. Then I sat down at the desk, pulled the nearest lamp close, and began to write. I wrote through the night. Not because anyone asked me to stay past my hours. No one had given me hours for this work. Technically, because no one had officially sanctioned it in the first place. I was a maid. I was assigned to clean this room, not think inside it. But the note was on the desk, and the fire was burning low, and the archive logs were spread before me like a puzzle I had already solved in my head, and I simply could not leave it undone. Petra knocked on the library door around the 9th hour of evening. I knew it was her by the knock. 3 short taps, the way she always announced herself to rooms she wasn't certain she was welcome in. You missed dinner, she said from the doorway. I know. She came in without being invited, which was also very Petra, and stood behind me for a moment looking at what I had written. I heard her breathing change, a small controlled intake, and then she was quiet. Rose, she said finally. I know, I said again. This is 12 pages. 14. I'm not finished. She pulled the chair from the corner and sat beside me without another word. After a moment, she reached over and restoked the fire, because that was Petra. She would not tell you to stop doing the thing that was going to complicate your life. But she would make sure you were warm while you did it. I finished around the 11th hour. 14 pages, organized into 4 sections. The original territorial agreements, the incremental amendments, the pattern of erosion, and the current material impact expressed in specific terms that a council of 12 powerful men
could not dismiss as abstract. No emotional language, no speculation. Only the documents, speaking in the sequence I had arranged them, which made the conclusion as inevitable as arithmetic. I set down the pen and looked at what I had made. "What happens," Petra said carefully, "when those 12 men ask who prepared this?" I hadn't let myself think about that directly. I thought about it now. "Xander will handle that," I said. "You're certain of that?" I wasn't. But I had made a choice somewhere in the middle of the night. Not a dramatic choice. Not the kind accompanied by a strong feeling of resolution. A quiet choice. The kind that happens when you stop pretending you don't know what you're doing. I had decided to do the work as well as I could do it, and let the consequences arrange themselves honestly. "I'm certain of the work," I said. "The rest isn't mine to control." Petra looked at me for a long moment with that particular expression she had. Not pity, not admiration, something more complicated than both. Then she stood, pressed her hand briefly to my shoulder, and left. I walked back to my room through the cold corridor with ink on my fingers and a strange, clean feeling in my chest, like a window opened in a room that had been shut too long. The council session was held in the war room, which was adjacent to the library through a connecting door that was always locked from the war room side. I had no access to it, and no reason to want any. My part was done. I had left the prepared document on the central desk before the first bell rang, and had gone about my actual assigned duties. The fire grates in the upper corridor, the window ledges in the guest passage, the endless quiet labor that kept the castle from noticing itself falling apart. I was polishing the brass fixtures in the corridor outside the war room at 9:30 when I heard the voices. Not words. The walls were too thick for that. But the shape of voices. The particular compressed sound of men arguing in a room designed to contain arguments. It rose and fell for nearly an hour. At one point it sharpened into something that sounded like a single voice cutting across all the others, and I recognized its cadence without needing to hear its content. Then silence, long enough that I moved to the next fixture. The connecting door between the war room and the library opened. I knew because I heard it, the particular groan of those old hinges that I had been meaning to oil for a month and hadn't gotten to yet. Footsteps in the library. Then the main library door opened directly into the corridor where I was working, and Corwin appeared with his silver hair and his permanently managed expression. He looked at me with the specific quality of attention of a man who has just been instructed to find someone he did not expect to be looking for. "The king requests your presence," he said. I set down my cloth. The war room was larger than the library and colder. It had fewer textiles, more stone, and the kind of deliberate austerity that communicated seriousness to everyone who entered it. The large central table was covered with maps and documents, and around it stood 11 men in various arrangements of formal pack council dress. Some were seated. Some had risen. All of them looked at me when I entered. Xander stood at the head of the table. He had the 14-page document in front of him. Beside it, I could see several other copies. Someone had reproduced it, distributed it among the council members. "This is Rose," Xander said to the room. She prepared the Halvern summary. The silence that followed had texture. I could feel 11 different varieties of reaction pressing against me from 11 different directions. Surprise, skepticism, calculation, dismissal, and in one case, from a heavy-set man near the window with a gray-streaked beard, something that looked uncomfortably like anger. That man spoke first. "This was prepared by a maid. It was prepared by someone who has spent 2 years in intimate familiarity with this archive," Xander said, without inflection. "I suggest the council evaluate the content, rather than the origin." "The content," said another man. Younger, precise-looking. The kind of face that belonged to someone trained in law. "Is difficult to argue with. Which is precisely what concerns me. Lord Vile." He nodded toward the gray-bearded man. "The fourth section implicates the Vile family's land management directly. Lord Vale's expression confirmed that. A document prepared outside formal channels by an unauthorized...
The authorization was mine, Xander said. Still no inflection. Still absolutely final.
Continue, Lord Vale.
Vial did not continue. He looked at me instead, with the particular look of a man filing something away for later use. And I held his gaze for exactly long enough to show that I had noted it. And then I looked at Xander.
You had a question for me, Your Majesty? I asked.
Something brief and very controlled moved across Xander's face.
Section 3. The Border Reassignment Clause from 41 years ago.
The Council disputes the interpretation. Walk us through your reading.
So I did.
I stood at the end of that table in my maid's uniform with ink still faintly visible on my right hand, and I walked 12 council members, 11 of whom had not known I existed this morning, through the documentary evidence of 40 years of incremental territorial adjustment. I spoke the way my father had taught me to speak when presenting records. Without decoration, without apology, with the kind of calm that comes not from confidence in yourself, but from confidence in the evidence.
Twice, Lord Vile interrupted. Both times, I waited for him to finish, and then continued from exactly where I had stopped, which I could tell irritated him more than any counterargument would have. When I finished, the room was quiet in a different way than it had been when I entered. Quieter, more like thought than dismissal. The younger, legal-minded man, I learned later his name was Counselor Drest, leaned back in his chair and looked at the document again.
The fourth clause does establish precedent, he said, mostly to the table. If the reassignment was conditional on continued resource-sharing agreements that were subsequently dissolved, he trailed off, working through something privately.
It means the current boundary position is not legally stable, Xander said, which is what we needed to establish before the Halvern delegation arrives next month.
That landed in the room with weight. The council absorbed it.
Lord Vial said nothing more.
But his eyes found me once before the session concluded, and I understood with the particular clarity of someone who had grown up reading between the lines that I had made an enemy in that room. Not because I had done anything wrong, because I had made something visible that he had benefited from remaining invisible.
Xander dismissed the council methodically, speaking individually to three members as they left, exchanging brief words with Corwin near the door.
I waited near the wall, not certain if I had been dismissed as well or not. When the room was empty except for the two of us, he came and stood at the end of the table and looked at me with those pale blue eyes.
You did well, he said.
The documents did the work, I said.
No. He picked up the original 14-page summary.
You did. The documents have been sitting in that archive for 40 years. No one arranged them until you did.
He set it down.
Lord Vial will cause problems. I want you to know that.
I suspected as much.
It doesn't concern you?
I considered the honest answer.
It concerns me, but it doesn't change what was true in the documents.
He looked at me steadily.
No, he said. It doesn't.
Outside the war room windows, the midday light was the flat gray of deep winter, pressing against the glass without warmth. Somewhere in the south wing, I knew. Lady Seraphine was conducting her own version of a morning, receiving visitors, preparing for the ceremonial fittings, managing the vast social machinery of a royal wedding 9 days away. Her life was enormous, and structured and visible in the way that mine was small and quiet and hidden. And yet, I was standing here.
Your Majesty, I said, because something had been building in me for days, and I did not have the architecture for comfortable silence when there was something true that needed to be said.
The letter from the Crestmore family, the one on your desk the morning I first saw you.
I paused.
You don't have to answer. But I've been reading documents long enough to recognize when someone is carrying a weight that the official version of a situation doesn't account for.
The silence was long.
Xander did not look away from me.
The Crestmore Alliance was arranged 18 months ago.
he said finally, before certain information about the Halvern territories came to light. He stopped, started again differently. Political alliances are built on assumptions about what both parties bring to the arrangement. When those assumptions change, the foundation shifts, I said quietly. Yes. And no one has told Lady Seraphine. It was not a question. He looked at me with something that was not quite surprise, but was close to it. The expression of a man who has said more than he intended and cannot determine whether that was a mistake. No, he said. Not yet. I thought about Seraphine in the library, hawk-eyed and precise, looking at my margin notes with that careful recalibration behind her composed face. I thought about what Petra had said about people who hoped the alliance would fall through, and people who hoped it would hold, and the danger of becoming a piece in someone else's story. She knows something has changed, I said. She came to the East Wing herself to look. She's not what people think she is, Your Majesty. She's not simply decorative. She notices things. Xander was quiet for a moment. Why are you telling me that? It was a fair question. I wasn't sure I had a clean answer. Because someone should, I said. And because whatever happens with the Alliance, she deserves to be spoken to honestly. Whoever she is politically, she's a person who traveled here for something she was promised, and she can tell that the ground has shifted. Leaving her to figure it out alone while everyone around her manages the situation is... I stopped myself. Is what? He said. Unkind, I said. Sire. The word sat in the air between us. I felt the potential weight of having overstepped, and I held my ground in it, because I had said what was true, and I would not walk it back. Xander looked at me for a long moment. Something moved behind his eyes. Slow, deep, the movement of water under ice. Then he nodded once, almost imperceptibly. Finish the East Wing corridor fixtures, he said, and be here tomorrow morning. I dipped my head and moved toward the door. Rose, I stopped. The work you did last night, he said. The council won't acknowledge it formally. The record will show the summary was prepared by the king's office. He paused. I want you to know that I know differently. I turned to look at him one more time. He was standing in the gray winter light with the 14 pages in his hand, and he looked exactly like what he was. A man carrying more weight than the official version of his situation accounted for. Doing the best he could with the truth as it actually existed. Thank you, Your Majesty, I said. And I meant it for more than one thing. The wedding was cancelled on a Thursday. Hi. I did not learn this through any dramatic announcement or corridor whisper or the particular velocity of rumor that moved through a castle when something significant shifted. I learned it the way I learned most things. Quietly. Through evidence. Through the texture of a morning that felt different before I had words for why. The south wing was too still. I noticed it when I crossed the inner courtyard at 5:30, carrying fresh linens to the guest passage. The stillness was not the peaceful kind. It was the held breath kind, the silence of people who have been told to wait and don't yet know what they're waiting for. Two of Seraphine's ladies-in-waiting were standing near the southern archway in their cloaks, speaking in voices too low to carry, their postures folded inward with the particular shape of women processing something unexpected. I kept walking. I delivered the linens. I returned to the East Wing. Xander was not in the library. For the first time in 8 mornings, the fire was not lit, and the room was cold, and the desk sat empty and undisturbed the way it had before all of this began. I stood in the doorway for a moment, looking at the familiar shapes of the shelves and the maps and the ladder, and I felt the absence of the morning's routine as a specific, located feeling. Not in my mind, but somewhere lower, more physical. Like a step you expect on a staircase that isn't there. I lit the fire myself. I sat at the desk and continued working on the Halvern cross-reference I had left unfinished the previous afternoon, because the work existed independent of everything else, and because I did not know what else to do with my hands. Corwin found me an hour later. He looked, for the first time in my experience of him, genuinely uncertain. The managed quality of his expression had developed a crack directly down the center, and beneath it was the face of a man navigating territory that his considerable experience had not specifically prepared him for. "The king is in the south wing," he said. "He has asked that you remain available this morning." "Available?" I repeated. "Here, in the east wing." Corwin paused. Then, in the tone of a man issuing information he has not been instructed to issue but feels is relevant, "Lady Seraphine requested an audience with the king at first bell this morning. They have been in conversation for 3 hours." I looked at him. "Is she all right?" The question seemed to surprise him. "She is..." He stopped. "Yes, she is composed. She is, in my experience of her, a remarkably composed woman." Another pause. "She came with her own documentation." I understood then. Or I understood the shape of it, at least, even if not the specific content. Seraphine had done her own reading. She had spent 9 days at Dravenmoor with those hawk eyes moving across every available surface, and she had drawn her own conclusions. And this morning, she had walked into a conversation that the official version of events had been avoiding. "Thank you, Corwin," I said. He nodded once, with the dignity of a man who has delivered what he came to deliver, and withdrew. I turned back to the archive log and read the same line 4 times without absorbing it. Seraphine came to the library herself at mid-morning. She was still composed, as Corwin had said, but the composition was different today. Less performed. She looked like a woman who had said difficult true things out loud and discovered they were survivable, which is a specific kind of freedom that reorganizes a face from the inside. She stood in the doorway and looked at me at the desk, and I stood immediately, because whatever had shifted this morning, she was still Lady Seraphine of Cressmore, and I was still Rose, East Wing senior maid. "Please sit," she said, which I had not expected. I sat. She came into the room and stood near the window, looking out at the gray winter courtyard below, her hands folded in front of her in a way that suggested deliberate calm rather than natural ease. "I owe you something," she said. "My lady, you don't..." "I do." She turned from the window. "I came to this room 9 days ago and I looked at your work on this desk, and I made a set of assumptions, and I went back to my quarters and I sat with those assumptions for 9 days, and this morning I went to Xander and I told him what I had concluded." She paused. "What I had concluded was correct. And the reason I was able to see it clearly rather than simply feel it as a vague discomfort was because of what I saw on this desk. Your notes. The structure of them." She looked at me directly. "You organized evidence in a way that made the truth legible. Not just on the Halvern question. The whole situation. I did not entirely understand, and I said so carefully." Seraphine was quiet for a moment. Then she said, "Xander and I were promised to each other by families who saw a political use in the connection. We have always known that. I respected him for his governance, and he respected me for my capability, and we were prepared to build something reasonable from that foundation." She looked at her hands. "But there is a difference between a foundation that is simply political and a foundation that is hollow. And what became clear to me, watching how this wing operated these past days, watching how Xander moved through his own castle, was that something fundamental had shifted in him. Not toward me. And he was too honorable to proceed without naming it, and too careful to name it without being certain." The room was very quiet. "My lady," I said, and my voice was not entirely steady, "I have not done anything." "I know," she said, and she almost smiled. "That is rather the point." She looked at me with those green eyes, clear and direct, and containing no malice that I could locate.
You didn't do anything. You simply were present, and honest, and useful. And that was enough to show him something he had been missing.
She paused.
That is not something you should apologize for.
I thought about Petra's words.
Be careful about what you allow yourself to become in someone else's story. But perhaps the thing Petra hadn't accounted for was the possibility of a story where everyone told the truth.
What will you do?
I asked her, because I could not not ask.
Seraphine straightened slightly. I will go home to Crestmore, she said.
And in the spring I will reopen the negotiation regarding the Halvern-adjacent territories from a position that no longer requires a marriage as its framework, because the Halvern summary that your council reviewed yesterday has already changed the terms of what Crestmore's cooperation is worth. She tilted her head slightly. You may not have intended it, but the work you did in this room also gave my family leverage we did not previously have documented. I stared at her. She did almost smile then, a real one, quick and wry. You're very good at this, she said. You should be doing it somewhere that acknowledges that. She moved toward the door, then paused. He'll be here shortly, I expect. He has things to say, and Xander is, if nothing else, a man who says the things he has determined need to be said. She looked at me one more time. Take care of this library. It's full of things worth knowing. And then Lady Seraphine of Crestmore walked out of the east wing with her chin level and her steps unhurried, and I heard her in the corridor issuing calm, clear instructions to her waiting ladies. And I understood that I had entirely misjudged the size of her. She was not a woman things happened to. She was a woman who happened to things, quietly and on her own terms. And she was going to be absolutely fine. Xander came at midday. He closed the door behind him. The main door, not the servants' entrance. And he stood for a moment just inside the room, looking at me the way he had looked at documents all these mornings. Carefully. Trying to see what was actually there rather than what he expected. I was standing near the desk. I had not sat back down after Seraphine left. I wasn't entirely sure my legs would have cooperated. She told me she spoke with you, he said. Yes. Are you all right? The question landed strangely, not because it was unwelcome, but because no one in this castle had directed that question at me with any real frequency in 2 years, and the sudden directness of it required a moment to absorb. Yes, I said. I think so. He crossed the room and stood on the other side of the desk, that wide oak surface between us that had become, over these strange 9 mornings, something like a shared space. A place where the rules about who could say what to whom had quietly suspended themselves in favor of something more honest. The alliance is dissolved, he said. By mutual agreement. Seraphine was... He stopped. Started again. She handled it with more grace than I deserved. She's remarkable, I said honestly. Yes. He looked at the desk. Rose, I need to say something to you, and I need to say it clearly, because I do not have a great deal of practice with this particular kind of honesty, and I don't want to manage it poorly. I waited. I don't know precisely when it happened, he said. There was no single moment I can identify cleanly. It was accumulative, the way real things usually are. He looked at me. You have been in this wing for nearly 2 years, and I walked past you without seeing you, because I was looking at everything in this castle the way I look at a map, for the strategic information, the borders, the weight-bearing structures. I was not looking at the people standing in the rooms. He paused. You made me look. I dusted your shelves, I said softly. That's all I did. You read every book on those shelves, he said. You reorganized 40 years of territorial history in a single night. You stood in front of my council and held your ground against Lord Vale without raising your voice. And you told me that my future queen deserved to be spoken to honestly when every person in a position of influence in this castle was carefully not saying that. He was quiet for a moment. You didn't do those things for any advantage.
You did them because they were true and necessary. I looked at him, at the exhaustion that still lived beneath his eyes, slightly less deep than it had been 9 days ago, at the scar along his jaw and the ink stain that had reappeared on his right wrist because he never remembered to check it before it dried, at the man who commanded territories and silenced councils and still lit his own fire in a cold library before 5 bells in the morning because he could not sleep and needed the comfort of work. "What are you asking me, Xander?" I said. His name, without the title. I had not planned it. It arrived the way honest things do, not chosen, but inevitable. He did not correct me. "I'm asking if you'll stay," he said. "Not as a maid.
Not as an archivist, although that's closer. I'm asking if you'll remain in this wing, in this work, beside me, while I figure out what this castle is supposed to become now that I'm looking at it properly."
He paused. "I am not asking you for anything you haven't chosen freely. I am not promising you that it will be simple, or that Lord Vale won't make things difficult, or that I'll always know how to say the right thing. I'm not good at the right thing. I'm better at the true thing." "The true thing is usually enough," I said.
"Is it?"
It was in the documents. Something shifted in his face then. Something deep and slow, like ice that has been holding a river in place, finally deciding to release it. Not a dramatic shift. A quiet one. The kind that changes everything without announcing itself.
"Stay," he said.
"Yes," I said.
What followed was not simple.
Petra had been right about that, as she was right about most things. Lord Vale made formal objection through the council to the dissolution of the Crestmore Alliance, and then made informal objection to my continued presence in the East Wing, and then made the specific mistake of making that informal objection loudly enough for Corwin to hear it in the corridor outside the war room. Corwin, who had developed over these 9 days a particular investment in the East Wing's continued operation, documented what he heard and placed it on Xander's desk without being asked. Xander addressed it in the next council session with the document in his hand and the particular quality of quiet that made the room very still. Lord Vael resigned from the council 4 days later, citing personal reasons. He returned to his territories in the east, where I later learned the Halvern boundary documentation had created legal complications for several of his family's landholdings. The work had consequences he had not anticipated when he dismissed it. Finn was reassigned from the administrative offices to the East Wing Archive Project, officially at Councillor Drest's recommendation, following the Halvern session. He arrived on his first morning with an ink stain on his chin and a look of barely contained enthusiasm that made the library feel warmer immediately. Petra, when I told her everything, was quiet for a long time. Then she refilled my teacup without being asked and said, "Well, I told you to be careful about what you became in someone else's story." She looked at me steadily. "I didn't say you couldn't write your own." Spring came late to Dravenmore, the way it always did. Reluctantly, incrementally, arriving not in a single transformation, but in a series of small decisions. A crocus near the east wall. The sound of the river below the outer gate moving faster. The quality of the morning light through the library windows shifting from flat gray to something that had warmth somewhere inside it. The Halvern delegation arrived in March. The negotiations took 11 days and resulted in a formal boundary agreement that had not existed in any stable form for 40 years. Councillor Drest led the legal team. The documentary foundation was the work prepared in the East Wing Library by a former maid who now held a formal position with the title of Royal Archivist and Territorial Records Advisor, a title that Corwin had created with visible satisfaction and which did not previously exist in the Dravenmore administrative structure. I was present for the signing. I stood near the window at the edge of the war room, not at the table. I was not yet at the table. That would come later. And I watched the Halvern representatives and the Dravenmore Council sign their names to a document that had its true beginning on a night when I sat alone in a cold library with ink on my hands and decided to do the work as well as I could do it and let the consequences arrange themselves honestly. Xander looked at me once,
briefly, across the room. Not a dramatic look. Not a proclamation. The quiet look of a man who sees a person he trusts in a room and is glad they are there. I looked back, equally quiet, equally certain. That was how it was with us. Not in grand gestures, but in the accumulated weight of mornings spent doing true work together, in the trust that grows between people who have decided to see each other clearly and keep doing so even when it is complicated. We were, both of us, better at the true thing than the right thing, and we had learned that this was sufficient. More than sufficient. It was the only foundation worth building on. Seraphine sent a letter in April. It arrived with the Crestmore seal in red wax, addressed to the East Wing Archive, which made Finn raise his eyebrows when he brought it to the desk. I opened it and read it twice, and then I set it flat on the desk and looked at it for a moment. It was brief, precise, and warm in the particular way that Seraphine was warm, not effusively, but genuinely, as a woman who chooses her words because she means them. The spring trade negotiations went well. My family's position has strengthened considerably, which I attribute in part to the clarity of the documentary record you established. I hope Dravenmore's library is treating you as well as it treated me, which is to say, better than most people thought it would. S. I wrote back. I told her the library was well, that the crocuses had come up near the east wall, that the Halvern Agreement had held through its first formal review. I told her I was glad she was all right. I meant all of it. There is a kind of life that happens in the foreground. Visible. Documented. Announced. And there is a kind of life that happens in the margins. In the footnotes. In the archive rooms that most people walk past without looking. I had lived the second kind for so long that I had almost made peace with it as a permanent condition. What I know now, in the way you know things that have stopped being ideas and become simply true, is that the margins are not lesser than the foreground. The footnotes are where the real agreements live. The archive is where you find out what actually happened, as opposed to what was announced. I had spent 2 years in this library becoming someone who could read that difference. And one cold winter morning, a king who had stopped sleeping had walked through a door he was supposed to be nowhere near, looked up at a woman on a ladder with a dust cloth in her hand, and seen, not a maid, not a background detail, not a piece of someone else's story, someone worth asking to stay. I had stayed. The library was quiet around me now. In the particular way it was quiet at the end of the afternoon, when the light went golden and the fire had burned to a steady, low warmth, and Finn had gone home, and the maps were rolled, and the archive logs were closed, and the work was done for the day. Xander would come soon. Not because he was supposed to, not because protocol required it, but because this room had become, for both of us, the place where the truest version of the day lived. I heard his footsteps in the corridor. Unhurried. Deliberate. The floorboards announcing him 2 steps before he arrived. The way they always had. The door opened. I did not look up from the document I was finishing. The Halvern secondary clause still needs a witness signature, I said. Corwin needs to come by tomorrow. I'll tell him, Xander said. He crossed the room and stood beside the desk, looking at what I was working on with the focused, quiet attention he gave to everything that mattered to him. The fire snapped softly. Outside, the last of the afternoon light was pulling back from the windows, leaving the sky a deep, clear blue. Rose, he said. You should know, he said, that the Eastern Lords have formally acknowledged the archive position. There will be a record entry tomorrow. I set down my pen. I looked at him. He looked back. Blue eyes, clear and steady, containing all the weight of a man who had learned, slowly, honestly, at considerable cost, how to see what was actually in front of him. It's official, then, I said. It's official, he said. I nodded once, picked up my pen, returned to the document. But I was smiling. Not dramatically.
not in a way that required acknowledgement or annotation. Quietly, in the way of someone who has come to a place they did not expect to arrive and found, against all previous evidence, that it was exactly where they were supposed to be. The fire burned low. The sky went dark. The library held us both in its familiar, book-scented quiet, surrounded by 40 years of history we had excavated together from the dust. And outside the leaded windows, the first stars appeared above Dravenmoor, small, steady, and exactly where they had always been, waiting only to be looked at properly. It was enough. It was, finally and completely, more than enough.